All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Gymfear 138 podcast. Today with special guest, the one, the only, the eminent sage and howitzer operator himself, Daddy Warpig. How's it going, man?
Same as always. It's been an exciting day on the internet, I tell you what.
It always seems to be.
It's specifically on my end, it's because the internet is, well, it's technical problems. People who have ever listened to Geek Gab know that we have technical problems. I have moved, physically moved locations, and the technical problems have just followed me. I'm beginning to think I should just go pig and start sacrificing small animals, and that's the only way to get these cleared up.
Or maybe you can appease the adversary by offering him a sacrifice.
Exactly. I'm not sure which pagan god would work out. I mean, I don't know. I haven't done all the research, so I can't really endorse one at this point. But I have to say this. I find Thor's economic policies to be most intriguing. So I'm kind of looking forward to learning some more about that.
Yeah, Thor was always a really interesting character. There's actually a podcast out there called Myths and Legends. And the guy delves into all of this world mythology and everything like that, and he tries to put it together in as clear a narrative as he can. Sometimes it's just impossible because the story's like, you know, like Gilgamesh at 6,000 years old, so what are you going to do? Yeah. But the stuff with Thor and Loki is always really, really interesting. I highly recommend the Myths and Legends cast if you're into world mythology. But you had a couple of topics that you wanted to discuss today, so hopefully we won't have the technical problems that we did earlier that stopped us from recording. But what did you specifically want to go over?
There was just one really main topic I wanted to cover, and then after that, you know, whatever you're interested in talking about. Specifically, it relates to that cartoon I tweeted at you last night.
Right.
And for those of you who I'm assuming that most of the people who are listening right now are people who have listened to your podcast before. So
most likely.
They will have heard the previous podcast. I'm going to read this cartoon. This is what I tweeted at Jim last night. It's a band. They're on stage. They're all dressed all alternatively, right? And the lead singer says, we don't have a name. That's too commercial. You know what? We're not going to play. That's also too commercial. Bye. And he throws the microphone down and walks away. And the audience turns to each other and says, what? Wow. So underground. I want all their records.
Yeah, I found that particularly amusing. That seems to crop up in just about every single, you know, indie music scene out there.
This is what I wanted to talk about. And it's not going to take a huge amount of time. Do you remember that model of what happens to a scene that I think QQ passed along to you, or it might have been Dan?
Model of what happens? Oh, yeah, with the mops and the
Yeah,
I remember that. For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, usually the way that this is kind of a new model of how fandoms, I guess you could say, progress. There will be, it'll start with a scene, and there'll be like, I don't know, 15 to 30 people. And those people are content creators, and they're really enthusiastic about this thing that's going on. And then eventually the thing will start to gain prominence because these people won't shut up about it. And you'll get, mops coming in. And the mops are people who just consume content. They don't make anything. They're just there to kind of enjoy what everybody else is doing. And the mops usually outweigh the content creators. That's when it kind of develops into, I guess, not a scene, but a subculture or a fandom. And then once a fandom progresses to a certain stage, you get the psychopaths coming in who are, they don't care about the thing. They don't care about the people involved in the thing. They don't care about the people who care about the thing. They care about making money off the thing. And usually they start to come in round about the time the thing is starting to die. And they get as much money as they can out of it, usually killing the thing in the process, and then move on to the next thing. So that's the basic model that we're working from here.
What I want to say is this. I think there's a lot of bad, or at least two specific main bad ideas that can come out of holding too close to that model. That model really only applies, or at least developed out of, music subcultures. It developed out of observing things like the birth of grunge in Seattle, the birth of rap in New York City, the birth of gangster rap on the West Coast, and so on and so forth. And what happens with those kinds of subcultures is exactly what that cartoon is talking about. The bands, the people who are producing music, generally speaking, aren't commercially oriented people. They're not really oriented towards selling stuff. They may have dreams of fame and fortune, but they're not really oriented. They're not really sharp business-wise, typically speaking.
Right. They're there to make the thing for everybody else to enjoy. They're not there they might be there to capitalize on it, but their main focus is, you know, making the thing.
And a lot of them even look down or sneer at making money. So obviously, the only people who are going to come in and sell this subculture are record company executives who are scum. They're psychopaths. They really are. They're bad people. And the contracts that recording artists have to sign are like a reinvention of slavery. They're awful.
Yeah, I've heard horror stories. I mean, I'm still a huge music nerd, but I used to be much worse back in high school. And I would read, you know, biographies of bands and stuff like that. And they're just horror stories out there about how these, and like knowing how like the music industry works, because you have to pay, you don't just pay the band. Whenever you go to a store and buy a CD, you're not just paying the band, you're paying everybody down the line. So the band is getting like 6 cents off the dollar for every CD that you sell.
Yeah.
And it's just an absolutely vicious way to run a business. It's unconscionable.
So as far as modeling what happens in the music industry, it's absolutely right. No problems with that, nothing at all. But I think it would be a bad idea to directly apply it to the pulp revolution. And here's why. One, if you think that the only people who are going to successfully sell are psychopaths, then you'll be even more inclined to think, well, then we just shouldn't be commercial at all. And this is also an attitude that comes out of the trans. It's an attitude that many anons have, which is they do it for free because they're anonymous. They get together to do operations. They do it for free. And so anyone who's trying to make money at whatever is by default evil. And so you saw it with people who like, well, William Usher's got a job as a journalist now. He's no longer doing it for free. He's doing something wrong. That's just not how the real world operates.
Right.
One, you have to make money. A creator has to make money to continue creating. Either that or they have to have a job that lets them continue creating for free on the side. I encourage people to look at Brian Niemeyer and to look at Rob Kreese and to look at Larry Correa, all these other people who started off or are still indie published. Look at what they do. They are very canny. They are very deliberate. They are trying very hard to make their work as marketable as possible and then market that work to readers. And if what you want to do is succeed as a scene, as a subculture, and as a creator, you have to be commercial. Don't tell yourself, well, only psychopaths are commercial. Go out, make stuff that appeals to an audience, and figure out how to find your audience so that you can start getting money. Kursova, in order to survive, has to make money. Sky Hernstrom has to make money. And we want them to make money so that they'll still be around doing this thing that we want them to do. That's how people can continue to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incentive thing, you know. Like, for the longest time, I was a content creator on YouTube. You know, I read creepypasta stories for fun. I did other stuff too, but the main focus of my channel eventually turned into reading scary stories on the internet for fun, for free. But then, you know, a friend showed me ACX, and he's like, hey, you can actually, you know, get paid doing this because, you know, you're good at it. And, you know, other people's opinions of my work aren't necessarily my own, but... But that really struck a chord with me because I don't know if it's just some problem that I have, but I don't do well in traditional employment. I don't do well working under other people, especially baby boomers. I don't know what the deal is, but like baby boomers, Gen X, I have a fucking problem working with those people. If you're going to come out here and do stuff, my main kind of thought process was, if you're going to come out here and do this stuff, it takes a lot of effort to make it good. It takes a lot of effort, like with the audiobooks thing. Like, much respect to LibriVox, but, you know, there's some issues there. And my biggest one is, I put a lot of work into my recordings. I put a lot of work into my audiobooks. And why would I sacrifice all my free time when I could be, I don't know, like playing video games or something like that, or, you know, doing something not work, basically? Why would I sacrifice all of this free time? We're talking like 72 hours a book over the span of however long, you know, maybe more than that. Why would I sacrifice all of that free time to not get paid for it, especially when I would rather be doing this full time? And the only way to do full time, or to do it full time, is to get commercial. You have to market yourself. You have to put out quality product that people are willing to pay for, and then figure out a way to get them to pay for it.
Exactly.
You know, that way, so if it, like I said with the incentive thing, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but like I said with the incentive thing, that's the incentive. If these people are getting paid for this at a level that will pay their bills every month and ensure that they're able to eat something other than like top ramen noodles, you know, for three meals a day or whatever, if they're getting paid at that level for what they're doing, then they're able to do it more often, and usually with better quality, because they don't have the stress of a day job hanging over their heads. So why I really just do not get the, oh, you're commercial, man, you sold out, you're trying to make money off of this. I really just do not understand this mentality, because if these people are making money off of it, then they can make that their day job, and then they can continue to deliver more content to you, the end consumer. Like, what's the problem here? Why is there this clash about them selling out? Now, I understand someone completely throwing away their principles and whatever, like just as an example, if Brian Niemeyer signed up with Tor Books, you know, then I would accuse him of selling out. But because he's out here doing it on his own, and he's sticking to his guns, and he has a set of principles, and he does not compromise them for anybody, I have nothing but respect for the dude, and I hope he's wildly financially successful with this.
Yeah. Don't be afraid of being commercial. If you want to write, you need to write for a living. You need to figure out how to, especially if you're going to be indie. And even if you're not, even if you're planning on getting a contract with a small publisher or a band or whoever, you're still going to need to promote your books anyway. You're still going to need to learn how to be commercial. Just start off learning. Brian gives out a lot of great advice. Larry gives out a ton of great advice. There are many other people who give out advice, some better, some worse. Learn how to be commercial. Be commercial out of the gate. That doesn't make you a psychopath. That doesn't make the people running Bayon Books or other booksellers psychopaths. In that sense, this model is misleading.
Perfect, yeah, at that point, they're facilitating the scene and the fandom rather than taking advantage of it.
And the last thing the last problem I have with the model is this. And I think it's MOPs. They refer to two people who are not creators, one of which are really, really heavy fans. I don't remember what term they use, but these are the people that organize stuff, that get things done, that aren't directly in bands, but you know, in the scenes, in the music scenes, they organize local shows. They, you know, get people together to come out and do whatever. And then there's what they call MOPs, and it's kind of derogatory. These are the people who, they almost phrase it like they're parasites. These are people who don't really want to spend any money at all. These are people who just come around. The thing is, what they call MOPs are actually what you should be calling an audience, okay?
Yeah.
These are the people who ideally you want to get to buy your stuff. You need them. You need the audience. These aren't people to sneer at. These aren't people to look down at. These are people to say, hey, and you know what? Maybe they're not as into pulp as you are, or as people who are pulp fans and are kind of involved around the periphery are. Maybe they haven't read every single pulp story. Maybe they haven't bought Appendix N, Jeff Rowe's Appendix N, and read it, but they really, really think that Larry Correia books are great. Or they really, really think that Brian Niemeyer's books are great. Or they really, really think that Sky Hernstrom is great or Kurosawa is great. They don't have to be inculcated in all of this stuff. They don't have to know who Lee Brackett is. They don't have to know who C.L. Moore is. They don't have to have read all of the stories of Robert E. Howard or all of the Tarzan books. As long as they are willing to buy books, as long as they are willing to put money down for anybody involved in the pulp revolution, those are valuable. Those are the people you want to cultivate. You want to make that person so damn excited by what they buy and read that they go out and tell their friends, hey, you should buy this and you should read it because it is just that damn awesome. So the danger of this model is if you take what it, as it was described to me, seriously, they view audience as parasites, and an audience is not parasites. Audiences are your meal ticket.
Well,
those
I mean,
the
there's
people who are going to be paying your bills.
Yeah, I totally understand where you're coming from. I think there's two different perspectives that we're coming at from here, and you and I are on the same page about this. I think the perspective of the article is while everybody who's actually creating content is still doing it for free, and the mops come around and just kind of soak it up, they really aren't contributing. They're kind of this is a bad way to phrase it, but they're kind of living off of the creativity of these other people. They're relying on them to keep the subculture, the subgenre, the fandom, or the scene, or whatever it is, going. When they very well could be out there creating content. So I can kind of understand the leech aspect of it, but if you look at it from a business-oriented aspect, as opposed to a non-sellout. That mentality. If you look at it from a business aspect instead of a sellout mentality, then yes, the mops are incredibly useful. They're the lifeblood of the fandom. You know, without those people, you'll just be a bunch of dickheads just like posting your stories wherever. Like, you know, there's entire, you know, groups of people on the chans that write stories, and some of them are actually really good, but they're just anonymous write facts. You know, they're not out there trying to monetize their content, but there's a whole subculture out there, small as it may be, that would pay for this kind of content. So, you know, but as soon as you stop doing it for free, it's, oh, he sold out. He's, you know, he's trying to make a living giving us what we want. How dare he expect us to pay him for what he's doing? You know, it's this kind of breakdown in perception. It's like, well, do you want this to be commercial? Do you want this to thrive? Do you want this to actually become a thing? Or do you want it to just be like 15 guys posting anonymously on an image board? Like, you know, what are you after here? And I've made no secret about the fact that I'm after a reasonable amount of commercial success. You know, I would love to quit my job tomorrow and just do audiobooks. That would be the dream right there. But I can't do that because I'm not making enough money to sustain my own life. If I did that, I would starve. You know, so it's this line that you have to walk between staying true to your principles and at the same time trying to get paid for staying true to your principles.
Yeah, it just, if you want to be successful as a writer, get better. If you want to be as successful as a writer, write and start selling your stuff and start cultivating an audience. If you want to be successful as a writer, establish some other platform that people can know you through and improve that so that people get to know you and are willing to listen to you and will be excited when you tell them that you've got a book coming out. All of this stuff is gone into in more depth again by Larry Correia, Brian Niemeyer, and other writers. In fact, there are entire sites out there. The only thing they publish are blog posts about how to be a successful independent writer. So pay attention to that. Don't be afraid of an audience. Don't be paranoid about so-called psychopaths. I'm not saying there aren't psychopaths out there, and I'm not saying that sooner or later there won't be some psychopath coming to the you know, Pulp Revolution scene, but it is not the music industry, especially with independent publishing. If you're out there publishing your stuff, you don't need the psychopaths at the big five publishers. You don't need the psychopaths at Tor. You have good people you can go to get help, and you are doing it on your own. You don't need a psychopath. Learn how to be commercial if that's what you want to do, and don't give away all your stuff for free. That's where a lot of bands get in trouble, is they give away the performance for free, and then the audience is there loving the performance, but they don't buy t-shirts, or they don't buy CDs or whatever. Well, they're just parasites. Well, you're giving away your concert for free, asshole. I mean, yeah, that's
why not problem. Why not charge people, like, you know, $2 at the door or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever's sustainable for your particular market. Honestly, like, I didn't know about this until, like, probably a month ago when I started looking into it. But, you know, so far as writing goes, direct-to-Kindle publishing is stupidly easy. Like, I thought there was going to be this big thing. I was going to have to buy software to convert my, you know, my writing into ebooks and stuff like that. I went and looked up on, you know, Amazon how to do the direct-to-Kindle publishing thing. And it's literally as simple as you write the Microsoft Word document, you format it properly, and then you send the Microsoft Word document to them. There's not really any excuse for not commercializing your writing unless you're just caught up on your particular principles of not getting paid for your work. You know, it really is that easy thanks to Amazon. You can just write your thing, edit it, format it properly, and then send it to them as a Microsoft Word document, and boom, you're on Kindle. You know, you're charging however much, 99 cents, $2, whatever, for your story. How is this a bad deal? Everybody gets paid. You get paid to do what you love. Your audience gets more content from you. I really just don't understand how this doesn't immediately click in people's heads as a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to point out either this article, these concepts, or the people who, you know, were spreading it as bad people. I absolutely am not trying to say anything negative about that. I just think there's some dangerous assumptions that go into that I don't want to see people fall into. Don't assume that being commercial is bad. Don't assume that people who can help you become a little bit more commercial friendly are necessarily bad people. You want an editor. You want to pay, if you're going to do this professionally, you want an editor. I'm not talking about just a copy editor. I'm not talking about a typo editor. You want someone like L. Jaggi Lamplighter, who can go through your book and say, here are structural problems. Here is how you can fix it. You need to take these two characters and get rid of one of them or combine them. You need to do this and do that to make your book better. You absolutely want to do that. If what you're trying to do is make money off of it, and you should be looking at making money off of it. I want people to be making money off of this. I want people to get excited about the pulps, get excited about the Pulp Revolution, and go out and make stuff of their own and sell it. You know, Raleigh Nyanzi, I apologize if I mispronounced your name, just released a novella. I want more people to do that. And I'll be perfectly honest, like 99% of the point of the stuff I write at the Castalia House blog is just to get people excited about the pulps, and just to get people who are already excited about the pulps excited about doing their own stuff. Get up, get out, do your own stuff, try to sell it, work hard, try to be better. That's exactly what I want to do. That's exactly what I want to see, is I want all of these people who are involved in this scene, who are involved in the, you know, whatever's going on with the Pulp Revolution, to make their mark on the world, to be good enough to be successful.
Yeah, and I mean, you and Jeffro have been accused of using hyperbole before, but the fact remains that hyperbole excites people. Hyperbole, you know, lights a fire under people's asses. It gets people going, it gets people excited. So, you know, I while I understand the detail-oriented people are a little bit leery of that kind of thing, you know, and I totally understand where they're coming from, because I like to be exact as much as possible, but sometimes you just have to say something to get people moving. you know, even if there's little quibbles with the factual correctness, even if it's not 100% right, you know, it could be mostly right or partway right, halfway right, whatever. Sometimes that kind of stuff will just get people moving. And if you whip people up in the right direction, everything tends to work out. Like with the psychopaths that we were talking about before. You know, I'm not really worried about the pulp revolution getting taken advantage of by psychopaths because, well, we're all already out here trying to take advantage of it. You know, we've got John Mollison, we've got Raul Nianzi, we've got, you know, me, you know, we've got people out here who are writing and publishing or soon to be publishing content that are trying to take advantage of this, that already are set up on the marketing end and the monetary and the economics end. So
by the way, folks, John Mollison, who does some excellent work in memes and on his blog, the Seagull Rising blog, just published a novella himself called Sudden Rescue. It's getting good reviews. People seem to really like it. They seem to really enjoy it. So that's also something to check out. If you're part of the Pulp Revolution, by all means, check out some of these people you hear about. See if you like their work. I'm not telling you to waste money on stuff you don't like, but see if you like their work. If you like their work, by all means, support them monetarily.
Yeah, and this is just a side note to John, because I know he's probably going to be listening to this. Start marketing your stuff more, dude. You're a good writer. You're a good writer. Start posting links on your Twitter to your stuff. You know, I don't have an insane reach, but I'll blog about it or tweet about it or whatever, you know, so just start pimping your writing more, dude. You're good. You deserve to get paid for it.
We have invited John on the show. We've invited him on my Geek Gab podcast that I do with Brian and John. And he, for circumstances that are outside of both of our control, he hasn't been able to come on, but he has been invited. And as soon as those circumstances clear up, he will be on the show. He can talk about his writing. So, okay. I'm very serious here. I like the Pulp Revolution. I'm heavily involved in it, and I'm doing my best to support the creators. I'm doing my best to support good stuff. I'm doing my best to, you know, prod people to push their stuff to a higher level of visibility. Like Nathan, who blogs occasionally at the Castalia House blog, Nathan Housley, had a couple of really great posts go up on his blog that didn't seem to get a lot of play, didn't seem to get a lot of attention. And they're absolutely critical, absolutely great posts. So I went to Jeff Rowe and I said, look, these are two great posts. You should put them up, you know, on the Castalia House blog. And I got the two of them hooked up so he can. You need to be, everyone involved in the Pulp Revolution needs to look at how to be canny at marketing their stuff. And even if it's just a blog post or an opinion piece, if it's got good information, if it's going to contribute to the health of the community, by all means, get up and get it out there the best you can.
And I mean, this is a problem that I have because I'm frequently self-conscious and self-deprecating about my work. Sorry about that. Like I say, I'm frequently self-conscious and self-deprecating about my own work. But if you've got something that you think is really good, go to people, say, hey, I wrote this thing, you know, would you mind sharing it around? You know, there's no shame in that. I have trouble taking my own advice, but if you're out there and you're wondering how you can kind of take advantage of this whole network of people who are trying to support new authors and indie authors and things like that, you know, there are people like me, there are people like Daddy Warpig, there are people like Jeff Rowe, who if they think you've got the goods, if they think you've got good stuff, they'll promote it. You know, speaking of which, I need to write a post about John Mollison's new story and direct people where to buy it. But, you know, there's no shame in asking for help, you know, especially if you're someone like me and you don't have a lot of reach, and the only reason you get, you know, however many hits on a post is because you had someone like Jeff Rowe on your podcast or whatever. there's no shame in going to people and asking for help. I swear to God, I've talked extensively to most of the people in this little movement that we've got going on, this little revolution, and they're very nice people. Very nice people.
If you have something to promote and you want to come on Geek Gab, then shoot me a line on Twitter or via email or whatever. I don't think we've ever... I have said no to some suggestions that my fellow hosts have made about people we should have on the show, at least once. I've said, no, I don't really want to have that person on the show. But everybody who's asked to come on the show, we've said yes to, even if it's been a difficulty getting things scheduled, or we've had technical difficulties. So, you know, we're open to, you know, people coming on the show, and I'm not saying we're absolutely guaranteed to get you on the show, but you were not going to put your name out there and laugh at you for asking. So,
yeah. So just go to people for help or exposure or anything. Like I said, we all kind of have this same ethos going on. We all want to get paid. We all want to increase the market. And this is kind of something that I brought up in that failure of a post that that I did a couple of days ago, at the time of this recording, at least. You know, we're all trying to increase this market because sci-fi and fantasy is not the best-selling genre out there. But at one time, it sold significantly more than it does now, at least to my understanding. You know, back when Burroughs was still active, or Howard was still active, you know, before they died. there was a lot more people reading this kind of stuff. Which is why I kind of, one of the reasons that I allied myself with the Pulp Revolution as opposed to the Superversives, because it's more accessible. It's, you know, your common person can pick up John Carter of Mars and really, really enjoy it. And your common person can pick up, you know, something by Clark, like 2001: A Space Odyssey, and just think, oh God, when is this going to end? And then go read something more interesting. So I think that the pulps are a way to get a bigger market. That's what I was going for. Yes, I remembered. You know, the market is what we're trying to reach here. We're trying to expand the market. And that can only be helped by more content creators. So if you've got something that you want to put out there, if you're trying to get in on this Pulp Revolution thing and you've got good material, and, you know, you're not some crazy person just trying to take advantage of this and publishing absolute shit and marketing it as Pulp Revolution, then we're more than willing to help you out. Or at least I am. I can't really speak for anybody else.
That's a big mistake right now in the Pulp Revolution. Anyway, publishing shit and trying to attach the Pulp Revolution's name to it. There was such a small group of people, such a small community, that it will get sniffed out almost instantly. And you might not get abused, but, you'll definitely find out how fast you can get ignored. anyways, that's really what I wanted to talk about. That was the entire subject. Is I thought that was an interesting subject. I thought that was something that I don't know. I want people to be excited about making money on it. I want people to be concentrating on making their stuff the best it can possibly be. Write the best stories you can possibly write, and then get them published in a way that you can get an audience. That's what I want to see. I want to see all these creators attached to the Pulp Revolution. Because, see, there's three markets here. You were talking about markets. There's actually three markets here, and all of them are ailing in different ways. The short fiction market is basically dead. There's still stuff being made. There's still anthologies being produced and what, but for the most part, it's dead. I want to see that reversed. I want to see Kursova magazine becoming astoundingly successful. I want to see, I think it's called Astounding Frontiers, is a new pulp magazine that the Superversive Press is going to be putting out in the next couple of months. I want to see that become absolutely successful. I'm assuming they're going to do good work, because I like Jason Rennie and I have confidence in him as an editor, and I think they are going to be doing good work. And I want to see short fiction expand to be a healthy market again, so that people can make money off of it enough to make it worthwhile to write a short story.
Yeah, and now we've got things like, you know, like, well, you mentioned Kursova, and they like Alexander has this specific, you know, kind of story that he's looking for, which isn't as limiting as it sounds. But, you know, we also have Story Hack coming along, and Lioness. Like, I was looking at their submission guidelines earlier today, and I was like, well, I could probably do this. And they specifically mention in the little description of everything that goes into submitting a story into Lioness that, you know, this isn't just something that will, you know, pay out one time and it's a one and done kind of thing. They keep paying. It will continue to earn, and you've already done the work, I believe is a reasonable paraphrase of what's up on the site. So we've got all of these people trying to bring short fiction back again, and I couldn't be more excited about it. Because honestly, a novel takes a lot of time to write, it takes a lot of time to edit, it takes a lot of time to fix, and it takes a lot of time to read. But a short story or a novella, you know, that maybe, like, for an audiobook, a novella is, like, maybe an hour, hour and a half. Maybe a little bit more, depending on the length of the story. But the short fiction really is where I think, like, science fiction and fantasy kind of lives and dies. You know, because it takes a certain type of person to produce a novel. But it also takes a certain type of person to produce short fiction. And I've come into this roadblock myself because I've tried writing novels in the past. I'm absolutely shit at it. I cannot put a novel together. But I can put together 15 short stories in the same, you know, sequential timeline. You know, so there's a certain type of person out there that writes short fiction. And honestly, I think that the creativity within short fiction is more boundless, I guess, than novel length stuff, because you can, you know, with a novel you have to keep everything together and worry about your continuity. With a short fiction story, you can write I don't know, like 1400 words. It's its own universe. It's completely its own thing. It obeys its own laws, and that's it. Boom, you're done. You can move on to the next thing. So I don't know. That's just kind of me, like, drunkenly looking at the structure of writing stories. But
so the other two markets we're involved in are the fantasy market. The fantasy market, financially speaking, is doing really well. In fact, people are often advised that what they really want to do, if they want to make money as a writer, is to start their own 10-volume epic fantasy series, each of 100,000 words, and that'll give you enough, if you're successful at it, if you can start selling, that'll give you enough money to live off of for the rest of your life. And then you can do whatever you want. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm not saying that's a bad advice. What I am saying is that however well epic fantasy might be doing, or fantasy in general might be doing as far as paying people's bills, it is absolutely creatively bankrupt for the most part. There are some exceptions, but for the most part, it is absolutely creatively bankrupt. And then what I want to see in fantasy is a reinvigoration of imagination. I want to see a reinvigoration of different concepts. I want to see people just completely throw away all of the laws and tropes of Tolkien-esque fantasy. It's not really Tolkien-esque. We can talk about that some other time or later. But I want to see people break out of these limitations of elves and knights and wizards fantasy and do something exciting, do something imaginative, do something. Go read some Dying Earth, or go read some Lord Dunsany, or go, you know, read Fayford and the Grey Mouser. Go read Conan. Go read other stuff and bring all this other stuff back to your writing. I want to see fantasy creatively reinvigorated. However well it's doing financially, it is absolutely bankrupt creatively.
Actually, I've been having this conversation with Alexander over at Kirsova via Twitter for the past few days, and a couple of other people have jumped in too, like Jesse Abraham Lucas. He's really fun to talk to.
I've read it. I haven't pitched in, but I've kept up with it.
But, you know, that's part of the reason that, well, that's the main reason that I released that post, Remove Knife Ears, or How to Improve Your Fantasy Setting. You know, that's just a weird little offshoot internet community that I kind of got involved in, you know, last year. But some of the people who write fiction for that, and yes, it is blue, blue in the sense of, you know, kind of romance, kind of. But the concepts for the races that they have worked up within the Monster Girl Wiki are not elves. They're not hobbits. They're not dwarves. You know, there's an entire culture there, or you can create your own culture. So this whole breathing life back into fantasy originality, I think could be drastically improved by taking the templates of these characters or these races and working them into traditional fantasy novels in a non, you know, niche fetish community way. In a story that I'm writing right now, today, I was thinking about making the elves that I had previously had attacking the main characters Valkyries. And, you know, not, like, actual Valkyrie come down from on high to carry the dead to their end, but just like a race of demi-humans that viewed that as their job, you know. That would be probably way more interesting than elves. You know, it doesn't really work for the story that I'm writing, but that's an option that you could go with. You know, so taking all of this inspiration from these different places doesn't just have to end at the old pulpy or old science fiction fantasy stories like Poole Anderson or people like that. You can take inspiration from anywhere. You can crack open a D&D monster manual and, you know, just thumb through the pages, open a page at random, put your finger down and say, okay, that's a sentient race now. And they're not, you know, this evil monster or whatever, you know, they're my interpretation of this race. You know, there's infinite possibilities here that we can use to revitalize fantasy, because we are stuck in a fucking rut. And the numbers might not bear this out, but as regards matters of, I guess, tropes used in stories over time, we've seen a lot more elf stories lately than we have stuff with anything, or just a straight fantasy story with just humans, you know, humans with magic, you know, that's a fantasy setting. Why are we limiting ourselves to this Tolkien-esque, you know, elves, dwarves, hobbits, blah, 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 on down the line? I think that there's more opportunities out there to take advantage of general creativity in the real world with regards to fantasy races than people think that there are.
Definitely people have gotten way too limited by a tiny subset of tropes, and it's time to break out of that. And I think the pulp revolution is a great place to start. And here's the other thing too. If you can do something new and unique and original and awesome, even if you're like stealing it from another source and then popularizing it, making it poppy, like, sanding off all the edges that are going to make mainstream audiences not like it, which I suggest you do. That is a suggestion. That's not an insult. If you can do that, you can really make something that's commercially appealing. I'm not saying every idea is going to be a winner, but that's one of the benefits of short stories, is you can toss a lot of different ideas out there and see which ones work or not. That's what a healthy short story market would do. Okay, so the third market that needs help is science fiction. And science fiction is financially moribund. And I got people who were sci-fi writers saying, well, I personally make money off of this, and my friends personally make money. And I'm like, that's fine. I'm just like, congratulations. Seriously, great. I'm happy that you're making money off of science fiction. I'm happy that you're making a living off of being a writer. That's awesome. I want to see more people do it. But the problem is, science fiction sells right now absolutely abysmally. It's the worst selling category on Amazon. It sells worse than everything else. Even boring, stodgy literary works
are really
selling science fiction. Yeah, I popped that up in one of my Castelli House posts, and Brian Niemeyer uses the same chart. Science fiction is the worst selling genre on Amazon right now.
That's crazy, especially Amazon given how popular science fiction is in, you know, general culture, at least with regards to America.
You have just recapitulated the entire thesis of one of my most controversial posts. But yeah, science fiction is insanely popular in movies. It's insanely popular, popular on television. But when it comes to printed science fiction works, it's dead, absolutely dead. I wrote three posts about this on the Staley House blog. You can go check them out there. Under the name Jason Jones, that's my name, but you can, it's looking for like science fiction is dead, what now? Or so you've killed science fiction, what to do? Who can bring science fiction back? I don't remember the exact titles, but it's something like that.
Yeah, if you look up my my post, Let's Talk Hard SF, I link to all of them. I actually trolled through the Castelli House blog and found all of the posts, and like 99% of the posts that I linked were written by you. But you can find all of them over there.
So you killed science fiction, now what? So who killed science fiction? So who can save science fiction? Those are the three posts. And you just exactly recapitulated the thesis. Science fiction is very, very popular in everything else but written form. Why is that? And what I'm telling you as writers, if you want to sell science fiction, what I want to see is writers writing mainstream-friendly stuff. I want to see them writing science fiction that a mainstream audience can latch onto and love. However you think that goes as a writer, it's up to you. I'm not going to tell you how to do it or exactly what to write. And I want to see the science fiction market grow. I want to see more people writing science fiction. I want to see more people buying science fiction. I want to see more people writing great science fiction and making a living at it. Because no matter how many people are doing it right now, it's not enough. It is crappy selling. Absolutely disastrously bad at selling. And I would like to see it get better. So those are the three markets. One of which is kind of healthy financially, the other two are not, and I want to see creatively and I want to see financially all of them do better. I want to see more people making money, especially writing, you know, pulp-oriented fiction. That's what I would love to see more of. For other reasons, I talk about in a different post on the blog is, you know, why is it that pulp-oriented fiction is so awesome? And that's in the so who can save science fiction? I talk about exactly why I want to see these stories get to be more popular. I want to see anyone listening to this, I want to see you writing. I want to see you doing great at your writing, getting better at your writing. I want to see you selling your writing. I want to see you becoming successful. And everything that I can do in order to promote that process, I'm doing.
Yeah, it's a very, very honorable pursuit. Honestly, this is, I think, my biggest disagreement. I've been thinking about this for the past couple of days because of that, you know, Spurglordy autism-laden rant that I published earlier in the week. And had Anthony M. over at Superversive SF respond to. I think that he thinks, you know, I might be misinterpreting, but this is the general gist that I'm gathering, is that the superversive will save science fiction. And I think that that's a good plan. You know, keep writing superversive stuff. But I think that the pulp stuff has a much wider appeal than the superversive stuff. So if we can generate enough interest via the pulp stuff, if we can get this out into more people's hands and more people come back to science fiction and fantasy and go, hey, these guys are doing, you know, short figure. I don't have to invest 30 hours in reading a novel and I can just read this really good short story. And wow, that's completely awesome. Then you can insert the superversive into that. And boom, both of our goals are accomplished. I just think that the pulp revolution is a better method to reach a wider audience. And a wider audience is what we all want. So that's kind of why I'm one of the pulp revolution guys, rather than, you know, allying myself specifically with the superversive movement. But yeah, that's the entire point, is to get this thing out there, get it bigger, save our genre. You know, the sci-fi fantasy genre has been kind of floundering for a while, at least to my understanding, and it really disheartens me that that is the case, because that's my shit. That's my thing. I love sci-fi and fantasy literature. It's my favorite thing to read. It's my favorite thing to listen to when I'm listening to audiobooks. And I don't want to see it disappear because there's no market for it. And I think that the market has been driven away by this literary focus. And if we bring back the pulps, then we can get common people who aren't interested in literary, hard-hitting sci-fi back into the genre and maybe interest them in the literary, hard-hitting sci-fi. You know, maybe this story about, you know, this Sword and Planet story, like At the Feet of Neptune's Queen by Abraham Strongjohn, may have screwed up the title there, but it's in Kirsova number 1.
Great story, by the way. Just fun.
Yeah, it was awesome. But that might get people more interested in, you know, literary sci-fi, which is a net benefit to the genre as a whole. So I really don't see how this is a bad thing. Like, I'm trying to like cut to the meat of the problem here. And the meat of the problem is that we don't have the audience right now. We don't have a big enough audience. We don't have enough people out there buying books. And the best way to do that, I think, is to start with the pulpy stuff that really super popularized sci-fi and fantasy back in the early 1900s all the way to the mid-1900s. And then we can work the superversive stuff in. You know, if that's your thing, go for it. But I really think that we have to popularize this first rather than commit to some kind of, and this isn't meant as an insult, commit to this dedication to bringing the superversive back to science fiction and fantasy.
It may be the culture I come from and where I live and the people I'm surrounded with in my day-to-day life. I'm going to put out there, this is specifically for anybody who's part of Superversive, SF, or, you know, in the Superversive movement or following that or whatever. This is my opinion. And I'm going to quote from, I'm going to give a quote you may recognize. A good tree can't bring forth evil fruit, and an evil tree can't bring forth good fruit. If what you want to do is write noble and virtuous and uplifting literature, you need to be a noble and virtuous and uplifting person. And if you are, if you're a generally decent person, if you're a generally moral person, then what you write will be uplifting and virtuous and noble. My concern isn't focusing on writing uplifting and virtuous and noble stuff, because I assume that those people who are that way will write it, and those people who aren't that way won't. My concern is making stuff that will be insanely popular, stuff that will excite an audience, stuff that will enrapt an audience, stuff that will entertain an audience, stuff that will make them excited and enthusiastic about your work specifically, you as an individual writer, that they will go out and tell other people, this is awesome, you need to read this writer, you need to buy this magazine, subscribe to it, you need to do whatever. And so that's why I'm more loudly involved in the pulp revolution than in Superversive. It's not that I don't, and I'm not, you know, I'm on the Superversive podcast pretty frequently, I'm on their mailing list, I talk to Jason, you know, fairly often. I'm not against them at all. I'm not even saying they're doing anything wrong. I'm not suggesting they should do anything different. I'm not criticizing them at all. My point is just that if we can make stuff that is awesome, if we can make stuff that draws the audience in, that gets them energized, that makes them love reading again, that makes them want to pay for stuff again, there is a huge group of people out there who don't read solely because there isn't anything that will make them want to read, solely because there isn't anything that's worth reading. And we need to make stuff that grabs the audience, that drags them through the story, that makes them excited about reading again, that makes them want to go out and read more like that. And if that's why I'm part of the pulp revolution, because I think that the pulp stories, the ethos, the aesthetics of pulp, the freedom from limitations of genre and tropes, I think that can get people who are not readers right now excited about it. And if you're a good person, if you're a decent person, and that's what you're doing, writing the most entertaining stuff you can, then I think that you're also going to be superversive, and I'm not really necessarily worried about that. I agree that that's a necessity, that we need entertainment like that in society. I just don't think that the way to get there is by focusing on superversive stuff itself. I think the way to get there is by getting writers thinking hard, critically thinking about their own stuff and saying, is this going to appeal to an audience? Is this going to excite my readers? How can I do this better? How can I make my language clearer? How can I make my stories move faster? How can I make my stories more entertaining? How can I make my stories more appealing to an underserved audience to draw them in? My thesis, okay, I'll stop with my thesis because I don't want it to detract from what I just said. I will stop that for right now.
But yeah, you and I are basically on the same page with that. Like, you know, like the superversive is very good, very good. I love those kind of stories. Even though I'm, you know, godless atheist heathen, I love those kind of stories that reveal a deeper truth to the universe, because A, I'm able to separate fantasy from reality, and B, that stuff is just really uplifting. It's nice to think in those terms. You know, even someone like me, I wouldn't classify myself as a nihilist or anything like that, but you know, someone like me who thinks that the universe has no meaning, therefore you have to make your own meaning, that kind of stuff is very, very edifying, because you can read about these characters making their own meaning out of what they personally believe. So if you write a story like Canticle for Leibowitz, which I just recently listened to the audiobook, it is amazing. It's such a good book. Because these characters believe so strongly in what they are doing, and they have well worked out reasons for believing that the way they do. And it's just, I don't know, just like putting myself in the place of these characters, like, yeah, I can totally 100% understand wanting to preserve knowledge for the sake of God. Yes, go for it. I think that stuff can be, you know, can be worked into fiction completely seamlessly, and it doesn't turn into message fiction. But you have to reach the audience first. So you can release like 15, 20 short stories via like StoryHack or Kirstova or whatever. Just like how John Mollison does it, just direct to Kindle Publishing. And you get the audience interested in what you're doing. Like if Schuler Hernstrom were to write a novel and publish it tomorrow, I would buy it. Just because I've read the guy's stuff before. I've read his short fiction, and I have no reason to doubt that he would be completely competent writing a novel. So I would buy it just on the basis of his reputation. But you have to build that reputation first. And I think that the pulp stuff is the best way to do that. You can build your reputation, you can gain an audience, and then you can release your supreme thesis. There's a Latin phrase for it, but I'm drunk, so I'm forgetting it right now. No, I'm not going to remember it. But then you can release this big novel, and then you can basically have a guaranteed audience that will buy it on the strength of your writing before. So I guess it's just the difference between, you know, long game and taking baby steps. Maybe that's a bad way to phrase it, but.
Yeah, so that's, you know, if you want to know why I'm doing Castalia House, if you want to know why I do the stuff I do on the Castalia House blog, it's exactly those goals. I want to get people excited about writing. I want to get people excited about making their writing the best they can. I want to get people excited about throwing off the shackles on your creativity, throwing off the shackles on your imagination. Learn how to write stuff that's great. Learn how to write stuff that's involving. Learn how to write stuff that is imaginative, that will get an audience, that will keep you in, you know, a job, that will support your life, that will let you be a professional writer. I know that not everyone who tries is going to be successful. I don't care. Give it a try. Be as successful as you can be. There's no reason not to try.
Yeah, so. I'm not gonna lie. You kind of also lit a fire under my ass with those posts. So you're partially responsible for the hell I will be unleashing onto the world as soon as my damn eye heals up. But yeah, like you, that fuck. I lost my train of thought.
But here's the thing, though.
Obviously, I need more liquor.
I want to say this in a very specific way. This is not a brag. This is not even a humble brag. I just want to reassure some people. It seems to me that since there's been this back and forth going on between the superversive crowd, that people are worried about the health of the superversive group, or people are worried about the health of the pulp revolution. People are worried that the pulp revolution is looking bad, or that a bitter feud between the two will damage both groups. And all I can say is Anthony wrote that he's not mad. He's not angry about it. He didn't mean to seem like he was angry about it. I just had a long talk with John C. Wright on Saturday, and he's not angry at me. He's not angry at the pulp revolution crowd. He's excited that we are getting people reading the old pulp stuff. The stuff I write is hyperbolic and inflammatory, but as long as I'm doing my job, and I have been doing my job up until now, and I hope to continue to do my job correctly. As long as I'm doing it right, as long as I'm doing what I'm supposed to, it's not going to hurt the Pulp Revolution or Superversive SF, and it's not going to, it's not going to long term, the effects it causes are not going to be bad. So let me tell you, out of this supposed battle, out of the supposed war, what's happened with Superversive SF. First off, they've gotten a big boost in the traffic to their site. People are now reading the Superversive SF blog more. They're now reading more posts on the Superversive SF blog.
Good. Jason Ryan just posted I'm about it. Very, very glad to hear that, because I love the Superversive guys, and I wish them all the success in the world. I hope that they blow up within the next 2 years.
John Della Rose has now started working for Superverse, and they started writing on their blog, and other people have started writing on their blog that weren't before all this happened. I'm not saying I planned this out because I didn't, and I'm not saying I'm a great person because I caused this. I'm not saying that at all. All I'm saying is, no matter how inflammatory my posts seem, I'm doing it with good intentions and with specific goals in mind, some of which I can talk about in public, some of which I can't, and good things will come out of it for the Pulp Revolution and for Superversive SF, as long as I'm doing my job correctly. And so that's all on me. But all I can point to is that after 2 months, I started on January 30th. That's when my first blog post went up on the Castalia House blog. After 2 months, I've helped drive more traffic. I'm not saying I'm solely responsible. I've helped drive more traffic to the Castalia House blog. I was a part of making it the most hits they've ever had in a single month. I've helped drive people and traffic to the Superversive SF blog. I am doing my job, and I'm doing it generally correctly. I'm not saying I'm perfect. And so you don't have to worry necessarily about how I'm making the Pulp Revolution look or causing big fights with Superversive SF, because by and large, it's not happening. Some commenter might be really, really angry. I can't help that. But for the most part, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And I would suggest just at this point having to trust me. Just let me do my thing. Let me do my thing my own way. And as long as I'm doing it for the right reasons and doing it the right way, it's having good results for everybody involved. I'm an asset to people, for everyone involved. Don't worry about me right now.
No, I totally 100% agree with you. I mean, like, there was a, yeah, it was the dust up with Anthony. Sorry, I've had a few. the dust up with Anthony M that happened, which actually turned out to not be a dust up at all, reveals that the Superverses, like, that's the one thing that I really hope that people take away from this, apart from the fact that I obviously have autism, which I haven't been medically diagnosed, but I don't think I need to anymore. But this recent dust up with my release of this post and with Anthony's response to it is that the Superversive movement and the Pulp Revolution is, they're allies. They're engaged in the same war. They're using different tactics to achieve the same goal, but ultimately we all want to better our genre and take down traditional publishing. So I just hope that that's what people kind of got out of that whole thing, because there really isn't a fight going on. It's just some, you know, some saber rattling between allied troops, and the whole, like, you know, how cavalry will tease infantry or something like that. And the whole, your wife, your sci-fi waifu is shit.
Do you know what the unofficial motto of the U.S. cavalry is?
No.
If you ain't cav, you ain't shit. Okay. Now, on Google Plus, on Facebook, and on Twitter, I posted a tweet which said, if it ain't pulp, it ain't shit. Specifically as a callback to the cav. My dad was in the cav when he first got into the military.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome.
And what you're saying is exactly correct. I'm not saying that other people who like science fiction are bad, hard science fiction are bad. I'm not saying that hard SF is bad. I was just, you know,
being hyperbolic to make a point and get people excited. So would you like to, just while we're here, would you like to walk back that hard SF doesn't exist thing?
I have yet to hear a single person who can all the people who disagreed with me, none of them have made a reasonable restatement of what the argument was. And so nobody has yet discounted the argument. Nobody has yet disproved the argument at all. But the argument isn't what they think it is. Oh,
don't say that, because then you're going to fucking challenge me, and I'm gonna go off into my Spurg cave and write another 3,000-word post.
The argument isn't what people thought it was. And I don't mean argument in the sense of fighting with someone. I mean the series of logical statements leading up to a conclusion isn't what people thought it was. And I haven't seen any sign that most people have even gotten into the core of it and really understood what I was saying. But I will say this. Let me say a similar thing in a slightly different way. The notion that there are big, heavy walls, iron curtain, right, between fantasy and science fiction, which was born in the 40s and 50s and has become basically holy writ. People don't even think about it now. Well, of course, fantasy and science fiction are two different things. And hard fantasy, hard SF, and science fantasy and soft science, all of that. Those are completely different things. There's this big wall between the two, and you should never mix it. And if you add some magic to science fiction, it's kind of genre bending, is the phrase I saw. That is completely 100% wrong. Hard science fiction, if that's the way you look at hard science fiction, that it's a completely separate thing and there are big, heavy walls around it, then that concept of hard science fiction is wrong. Hard science fiction does not exist. But if you look at fantasy in the same way, that there are big, heavy walls between fantasy and science fiction, and that you should never have rocket ships and ray guns in a fantasy story, then fantasy doesn't exist. That concept of fantasy is misplaced. That concept of fantasy literally does not exist. All these are separate subcategories of one genre, fantasy and science fiction. They're just separate subcategories with very, very fuzzy borders, and a story might be considered part of one, it might be considered part of something else, and you can make an argument either way, and more importantly, as a writer, you don't have to care, and you shouldn't care. Go out and write exactly what you want to write. Don't worry about what genre it fits in, or whether you're following some tilly little rule of that specific genre. Don't worry about it. Write the most awesome story you can. Write the most entertaining story you can. Write the most audience-pleasing story you can, and don't worry about genre at all. So I would say, if that's your conception of hard SF, that it's completely, utterly separate, and there's a big, huge wall around it, and there's these exact criteria for hard SF, and anybody that doesn't match these criteria isn't hard SF, that doesn't exist. Hard SF like that doesn't exist. It's something completely different.
Actually, we have a bit of confirmation from Carl K. Gallagher, who I believe wrote the Torch Ship series. On my original post, Let's Talk Hard SF, he left this not exactly lengthy comment, but he kind of wondered where I had gotten the notion of all of this, and I'm not gonna lie, kind of got it from you. It was spurred on by your articles at Castalia House, but I also started to think back to conversations that I've had with other nerds about, you know, science fiction, fantasy, all of that, and eventually it delved into hard, you know, quote unquote hard SF, and eventually we started talking about how, you know, oh, it's great, you know, he was so scientifically accurate for his time, but, you know, now we know better. You know, that's why I brought that up. That was, excuse me, I seem to have developed the hiccups. But that's something that I've noticed in conversations with a lot of nerds about science fiction specifically. One thing that I'm insanely grateful to you for bringing up is the lack of a division between fantasy, this fake division between fantasy and science fiction. So Carl made a really good point with that, that it's not really, you know, it's not really a set, you know, this comes down from the Holy Father kind of writ, but it is kind of generally accepted, in my opinion. But the fake split between fantasy and science fiction, that was completely blown away by reading Jack Vance's Planet of Adventure, because that's a fantasy story. That's absolutely a fantasy story. You know, there's this one world. It's like the difference between Warhammer 40K and Warhammer Fantasy. You know, in Warhammer 40K, you have basically the exact same races with the exact same religious, you know, affiliations and whatnot, but they're all spread out all over the galaxy. In Warhammer Fantasy, you have all of pretty much the same thing. There's little deviations here and there between the two, but it's basically the same exact universe concentrated on this one planet. And that's what Jack Vance did with Planet of Adventure. He concentrated this fantasy milieu over one planet. And there's Blue Chosh, there's Red Chosh, there's Old Chosh, there's, you know, the Fung, the Noom, the Wonk, the Dirter, and then there's various, you know, differentiations between the human slaves of these different, like the Wonkmen, the Dirtermen, the Choshmen, that kind of thing. So he basically took the concept of a fantasy world where you're on one planet, but you have all of these different races going on and warring with one another, but put it into a sci-fi setting where it's this alien planet, and this guy crash lands onto it and has to kind of deal with everything that's going on. And it blew my mind so much. There was brain spattered all over the walls while I was listening to this. I was so angry that I had thought that for years I had thought that science fiction, if you want to write a good science fiction universe, you have to set it out with, you know, this big universe spanning thing, and this planet is controlled by this race, and this planet is controlled by that race, and, you know, on and on down the line, and there's mixing on certain planets. But nothing that I had read before in science fiction and fantasy had prepared me for what Jack Vance did with Planet of Adventure. It was a fantasy story with sci-fi trappings. And it was just so amazing to me that somebody could do that, that I've completely, like, I'm so angry that I thought that there was this division between the two genres, because I could have been writing mixed genre stuff years ago. I could have been, you know, flexing this muscle all kinds of ways for years. But no, I've been stilted by this false perception that fantasy and science fiction have to be two separate genres. And if you want to write fantasy and science fiction as two separate genres, fine, I'm not going to knock you at all. That's 100% okay with me. But the idea that they can be mixed never entered into my head, never once entered into my cognition before I read your blog posts and listened to the audiobook of Planet of Adventure. Never once did I think that it was possible to take, you know, your basic fantasy setting and introduce sci-fi elements into it, and that everything would be okay. You know, I don't know why I had this blinder on, but that's just the way it was for so many years. And when I realized that blinder did not have to be there, that I could have torn it off at any time and been riding elves in space, or, you know, some other fantasy race to not piss off Alexander. But to think that I could have been doing that for so many years, it's just so, like, the lost time makes me so fucking angry that I went psycho there for a little while, and I started up with the same, you know, hard sci-fi is a fucking joke kind of thing. But I reined that in, and I got control of that, and now I'm just like, okay, well, why don't we just do this thing, and why don't we just mix the genres, because who really cares if what taxonomical classification this story falls into? Let's just have fun with the story, you know?
And here's the thing, that's not an unusual reaction, because for various reasons about a project I've been doing for a very long time, I have become more educated about genre and genre tropes and what fits into certain genres here and there. I've done more research into what genre is and how genre operates than I would be willing to bet than just about anybody else I've talked to about the subject. And I used to be very, very strict about genre. Because I just thought that's the way it was. I didn't even think about it. It just was what it was. And it wasn't until I started reading this stuff that that Jeffro was suggesting, because of his appendix and blog posts, this is long before he published his book, and started reading the stuff that got published in Kursova, that all of a sudden it clicked on, that all of this genre stuff was just a constraint. It may be fine in a limited sense to guide audiences towards books they might like, but at the same time, all it is, fundamentally speaking, all that speculative fiction or that fantasy and science fiction genres are differences in props, costumes, and scenery. That's it. If it's got spaceships and ray guns, it's science fiction. If it has men in pointy hats who mumble words and shake their fingers and do stuff, then it's fantasy. Okay? That's the only difference. The difference between these genres are what kind of props, costumes, and scenery you'd like. And once I reached that point, I was like, look, these stories break genre walls. They do whatever they want. They're awesome. That's what you should do. You should, you know, Conan stories will have in the exact same story, horror and Western and fantasy elements.
And horror. Some of them, there was
sci-fi.
And, you know, there were plenty of Conan stories that involved horror, you know, so. That's just like we talk a lot about fantasy and sci-fi, but horror is a subset of speculative fiction, and it's more than acceptable to bring that into your universe. Brian Niemeyer did that very, very well with Netherial.
I just want to reassure people. If you think I'm being inflammatory for clicks, I've heard that a lot. People saying, "Oh, well, I guess." You know, I guess being...
The people who think that you're doing this for clickbait haven't actually read the articles.
I don't get anything. Me personally, I don't benefit from any of this. I'm not doing anything that I see benefit from. If 10 people click on an article I wrote at Castalia House or 1,000 people do, I don't get anything else from it. I'm not getting paid for it. I'm doing this for free. So no, I'm not doing this to be controversial. I'm not doing it for the clicks. Trust me. I don't need clicks. I'm not doing this for myself. I'm not doing this because of me, to benefit me. I'm doing this to benefit the Pulp Revolution. I'm doing this to benefit the people in the Pulp Revolution, to give you a glimpse of what your writing is like without limitations, to give you excitement for writing, to give you motivation to write, to reassure you that what you're writing is good stuff, it's worthwhile stuff, and you can find audience. There is an audience out there, you can grow the audience, and that there is no reason for you personally not to try. You are.
Honestly, the lack of limitations is so exciting to me, because I'm kind of libertarian, I guess, but... recently, I got a hold of, if you look up The Evil DM on Twitter, he put together with a couple of friends of his a rule set called Mazes and Perils, and it's a first edition D&D clone, and the rules are so sparse and loose that the DM guide, the player's manual, and the monster manual are the same 74-page PDF. So I was talking about this with some of my friends that I do a Pathfinder group with, and I was like, well, you know, this is really cool because there's, you know, no restrictions here. You can do whatever you want within the rules. And one of my friends responded with, I don't know, this sounds a little bit more complicated than Pathfinder. More complicated than Pathfinder. Pathfinder has an entire website with thousands of pages that delineate all of the rules in every single situation. Like, if you have a conflict in game, with enough searching, you can find the rule that addresses it within Pathfinder. But this is just meant to be an analogy. I'm not talking about the relative merits of first edition D&D over Pathfinder. But the point is that the Mazes and Perils rules, or the first edition D&D or AD&D rules, offer the DM and the player a lot more freedom than the Pathfinder rules. There's a lot more house rulings going on in first edition than there are in Pathfinder, because you can just look at, oh, well, the rules say this, so that's what we have to do. And with the pulp stuff, and specifically Appendix N, having the constraints torn off, you don't have to write in this specific genre. You don't have to write just SF. You can write science fantasy. You can write, you know, fantasy with a little bit of science fiction in it, you know, World of Warcraft might be a good example, because that's ostensibly a fantasy world, but the Draenei are aliens, and they're just kind of crashed on this planet, and they have to kind of deal with everything that's going on. You know, that's a science fantasy setting. It's no surprise that that's ridiculously, retardedly popular. You know, Samurai Jack. That's something that's seen some resurgence recently with the new show coming out. Samurai Jack is a science fantasy setting. This concept of blending the genres and just ripping down the restrictions between the genre walls, or ripping down the walls between the genres, is so powerful and so freeing that I can understand how people would think it was intimidating. Just like that friend of mine who thought that the Mazes and Peril rules were too light, and therefore too restrictive. I can understand how you would think that, because we've all been living in this headspace for the past God only knows how many years, where the genres have strict definition. And if you merge those genres, or if you kind of play with them like they're silly putty, then you're not doing this seriously. You're not, you know, you're not a serious science fiction author, or you're not a serious fantasy author, or what have you. This mentality has dominated us for so long that we don't know any other way to think. And that's part of the reason that I'm so personally angry about this. About all of the Appendix N books nearly being memory hold. You know, if I had known about Poole Anderson or Jack Vance back when I was in high school, when I was reading R.A. Salvatore and the Dragonlance series, you know, there would have been infinite possibilities for my own writing that were opened up, and I could have done whatever I wanted with it. Now, I'm struggling to break out of, okay, you've got elves in your stories, what makes you original? You know, I'm struggling to break out of that because I've been locked into this mode of thought for so long that a fantasy story has to include X, Y, and Z. And if you include, you know, P, then you're a science fiction story, you're not a fantasy story. So this I think is the most important thing that you guys are doing here, is tearing down these genre walls. Now, if the genres still exist. I'm not making the case that they don't. But if you want to write hard SF, go for it. If you want to write science fantasy, go for it. But we need to let more people know that these genre restrictions, I guess, to use an uncharitable word that I don't mean to be uncharitable, if these genre...
genre straitjackets, confines, genre prisonless cells. I've used all of these as analogies at one time or another.
If these genre straitjackets aren't as restrictive as people think they are, then you could absolutely write a story like John Carter. You know, in the first John Carter book, he gets to Mars by basically dying and wishing really hard. That's how he got to Mars. But it's still technically a science fiction story, because we're talking about Mars and there's, you know, all these different races running around and what have you. But
okay,
it just kind of unleashes this level of creativity that has not necessarily heretofore, but for the past few decades, been unheard of in science fiction and fantasy. You know, people are now allowed to do whatever they want. And if that includes, you know, ray guns and elves, fucking go for it. If you can make it work, then why not try to make it work and make money off of it?
I want to challenge people to go out and read How to Write Fantasy and Science Fiction by Orson Scott Card. Because
this should be
in How to Write Fantasy and Science Fiction, he specifically says that the only differences between science fiction and fantasy, this is Orson Scott Card, one of the foremost preeminent science fiction authors of all time, has what is widely considered to be the number one science fiction novel ever written by a lot of people. That's Ender's Game.
Ender's Game is very, very good.
Specifically, that there is no difference between fantasy and science fiction, that they are the same thing, just with different scenery and props and costumes. He tells the story of how he wrote the short story and sent it in to a magazine, and they turned it back and said, this is a science fiction magazine, not a fantasy magazine. He's like, well, wait a minute. You know, I tried to explain that all this stuff that was going on was psionics, but it was set in a medieval period. It was apparently magical abilities. And so therefore, he realized it really was fantasy because he didn't make what was supposed to be science fictional explicit and didn't make it come out in the story. Orson Scott Card, one of the most widely praised science fiction authors ever, says that fantasy and science fiction are the same genre, just with minor differences. If it's set in a medieval time period with what seem to be magicians, it's fantasy. And if it's set in a high technology period with spaceships, then it's science fiction. That's the only difference. Everything else are just rules that writers set up to play with stuff, or that writers have allowed be imposed on their imaginations by, generally speaking, by spurred lords who can't write as well as you, so don't listen to them.
Yeah, I mean, that's honestly one of the reasons, not to hop on Brian Niemeyer's dick any more than I already do, but that's one of the things that really excited me about Netherial while I was reading this, because I was reading it about the same time I was listening to Planet of Adventure. And there's magic in that book, but the book takes place in space. Like, there's this whole Firefly style entire universe thing going on where there's different planets that the characters go to, and they use spaceships and they have ray guns, but they also still use swords, and certain of these characters are able to use magic and stuff like that. It's just like after reading that, I do not understand why authors would, limit themselves. I know that phrase might be kind of contentious in certain circles, but I see it as a limitation to not include these things that, in my opinion, obviously make the story better. They obviously enhance the setting. You know, it would be absolutely baller to have a Netherial RPG out there where I could get, five friends together and, you know, play in Netherial, but, you know, play as a djinn or a half djinn or, damn it. I'm too drunk to remember the name of the mages in the story, but like that's magic. What these people are doing is magic. There's no scientific explanation proffered in the story whatsoever, and it works, and it's so good, and it mixes the three speculative fiction genres so well that after reading that, everything else is inferior. And like I said, I don't mean to hop on Brian Niemeyer's dick too much here, but after reading Netherial, which mixes fantasy and science fiction and horror so well, everything else that tries to conform to those genres or accidentally conforms to those genres is just, it's just inferior to me. I can't look at that as, you know, this person letting their imagination run wild, because I've seen what happens when someone lets their imagination run completely buck fucking wild naked in the fields. And it's amazing. It's better than I would say. And once again, I'm not trying to get on Brian Niemeyer's good side. This is an honest opinion for me. I would say that Netherial is better than 95% of the science fiction and fantasy that I've read in the past 15 years when I started reading it seriously. You know, it's better than the Forgotten Realms stuff. It's better than Dragonlance. It's better than Dune. It's better than all of this stuff because he let his imagination go and he tore down these genre walls and he did things that I did not think were possible within these false constrictions of genre lines that I had been inculcated into since I started reading the genre back when I was a little kid. You know, I've never read anything like Netherial before. And it absolutely blew my socks off. So I think that that's a big benefit to what you're doing with the Castalia House. Even if your howitzer, you know, happens to have a little bit of collateral damage, I think that the net benefit is absolutely worth it. If people realize that they can literally do whatever they want. And by literally, I mean literally. Go do whatever you want. You don't have to be constrained by Tolkien-esque restraints. You don't have to be constrained by how elves are supposed to be. All of this stuff just goes completely out the fucking window.
So I want to say this. I've got some time left, but I'm going to have to be kicking off sometime in the next probably like half an hour or so. Do you have any questions that you've either seen people ask or that you have about the stuff I've written? Things you think ought to be clarified or things you think I am wrong about or whatever?
Well, I didn't really go and like reread those posts in the comment sections before we started recording. But I think the whole there is no hard SF. And we touched on this earlier in the podcast. I don't know if we actually, like, you know, nailed down what you were actually trying to say. But that, honestly, is the biggest contention that I've seen. Like, there has been unlimited ass hurt from the people who are like, yeah, yeah, my waifu isn't shit!
it's really, really simple. People say the idea, the concept between hard SF is everything in the fiction follows scientific laws.
Right.
That's what hard SF is. If you break the laws of science, it's not hard SF. Now, other people have come out and said, well, no, you're allowed one and precisely one thing or it's not hard SF. I'm like, okay, whatever. My point was that you as a writer don't know whether anything you're writing is going to break those laws or not. Or that you're going to think you're following him today, assuming that you've gotten a physics degree and you really fully understand physics, which I guarantee you, writers do not really understand physics because they're not physicists, and you shouldn't have to understand physics to write a good story. So, one, there's the impossibility of education. You can't know if the stuff you're writing really does or doesn't follow physics. You're probably going to have it wrong. Two, physics is a constantly moving field. They constantly add new ideas to it and take ideas away. Things are constantly being invalidated. So stuff you write today that you think is hard science fiction will be in a year's time or 10 years time completely soft science fiction, ridiculous, foolish, stupid, contemptible. We can't believe people used to believe that. So if a story can be instantly invalidated, can be not hard science fiction, then this concept, this platonic idea there is this pure science fiction that can be written, which perfectly conforms to science as we know it, is fake. It's a delusion. You as a writer almost certainly can't write stuff that is that scientifically accurate. And even if you do, it's going to be invalidated quickly or slowly. It's going to be invalidated. So the number of stories that can actually do this and then actually stay in that category are zero or close to zero. So a genre with zero stories in it doesn't exist. If there's no stories that match your genre criteria, then that genre doesn't exist.
Okay, I can see where you're coming from. But once again, after my post, referring back to Carl K. Gallagher's comment on that, I might be able to pull up the actual thing. But the point that he made in general, and I'm paraphrasing at best, is that part of the fun of the hard SF crowd is having it disproved. You know, people like poking holes in things.
That's completely orthogonal to the actual point I was making. I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm just saying that like all the other comments I've seen, it's doesn't yeah, actually
here,
address the original.
Here it is. I actually have the actual comment if you want to hear it. The part that's germane to what we're talking about is quote, seeing your science superseded by new facts is part of the fun in the game. It happens to everyone. Larry Niven's first published story, The Coldest Place, was negated by research finding Mercury wasn't locked to the sun. The Martian's adventures in water making became superfluous when NASA discovered permafrost, where Andy Weir set the story. Fans will try to poke holes in a story's science. This is part of what hard SF fans enjoy, end quote.
He's missing the point of what I'm saying. I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm not saying that's bad. See, this is the thing. When you get on the internet, whatever you say that could be critiquing a particular band or a particular TV show or a particular genre, its fans don't hear, well, this one specific thing falls short. What they hear is, this entire show or band or sports team is crap. I hate it. And that's how they react. They say, no, it's not. My stuff isn't crap. And the only comment I can make to go back to it, because that's what most of the other responses to this piece have been. Well, hard science fiction isn't crap. I didn't say hard science fiction isn't crap. I said that this platonic ideal of hard science fiction is physically impossible. It can't exist.
Maybe we should explain what people mean by platonic ideal. This is going to be really bad, but basically Plato had this ideal of ideal forms. He had the idea of ideal forms, and there was the ideal form of a tree, and every tree that exists in the actual physical world that we all exist in is just an approximation of that ideal form. So that's what Daddy Warpig is talking about here. There's this platonic ideal form of hard science fiction. Everything that actually exists within the category hard science fiction will just be a rough approximation of that form rather than being the physical manifestation of that form. So we're not talking about, like, you know, I really like this guy as a friend kind of stuff.
So I want to read this, though, because this is the core of what I was saying. This is the exact point of the article, which people seem to have missed. I'm quoting myself now. I'm not saying scientific accuracy is a bad thing, but rather that minute and pedantic adherence to current scientific knowledge isn't necessary for a good science fiction story. Audiences don't want realism, and they don't want accuracy. They want a good story, well told, with a veneer of verisimilitude, a story that is believable enough to believe in, whether it's actually scientifically accurate or not. This is so much the case that even hard SF cultists will gladly accept something that is scientifically impossible in the interest of a good story. And that comment, by the way, that sentence was proven right later because someone in the comment said that exact thing. When it comes to great storytelling, even hard SF hard cases wink at violations of science. All you have to do is give them a good enough excuse, and they'll happily accept whatever it is you're peddling, whether it really makes scientific sense or not. Scientific or technical accuracy should never be allowed to wreck a good tale. Stories which elevate these elements above all others may appeal to a narrow slice of the audience, but they generally repel the mainstream. Such stories should never have become the dominant or sole form of science fiction, and the effort to make them such coincided with the collapse in sales of science fiction and its relegation to a ghetto genre fit only for adolescents and nerdy adults.
Yeah, I think you and I are exactly on the same page there.
So, again, I'm not saying that hard science fiction is bad. I'm not saying that wanting to value scientific accuracy is bad. I'm not telling people your waifu is shit. What I'm saying is that is the
well,
core
you
of the
are,
point
but you are telling people their waifu is shit, but it's all tongue in cheek.
And I don't think people have really, anybody who has objected to that article, none of them have really grappled with the central or core assertion of it. The one person who made a good point was John C. Wright, who said, well, that's not how I define hard SF. I define it in a completely different and reasonable way. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. I wrote an entire follow-up post that said, okay, I accept John C. Wright's definition. That seems great to me. I have no problem with it. So it's just it's not so much that there's an ongoing fight, because I haven't really brought this up again. I haven't written additional posts about it. It's just that all the people angry about it don't, they've never really got it in the first place. Never really understood the argument in the first place. They just thought I was saying the hard SF is bad. No, I think the hard SF is, as a ontological matter, less entertaining to general audiences, to most people, than something that is action-oriented like most of the pulps. I think that's factual. I think that is empirically supportable. But that doesn't mean that hard SF is bad, or that it shouldn't be written, or that I'm coming to take your hard SF stories from you. And I have people who have literally said in response to what I've written, you can have my Heinlein when you pry it from my cold dead fingers. I'm like, dude, I had to write an entire response piece just to that comment. I'm like, I'm not coming for your hard SF story. I don't want to destroy them. Maybe you should.
I think that would be,
they don't understand.
I think that would be a good point to make while we're here, is that, you know, very probably Jeffro, the other people involved in the pulp revolution, we don't want to destroy hard SF. We just want to make sure that there's room in the genre and equal standing for the less scientifically accurate stories.
Honestly, I think that the pulp revolution is still in the process of building a community and still in the process of recruiting creators, getting people excited about this stuff, getting people excited about creating it, and that as we get more and more creators and they get better and better skilled at what they're doing, that the audience will grow and the audience will come into the pulp revolution, and that the pulp revolution will become more and more successful. That's what I believe. That's what I predict. And that I don't know how big the final audience size will be, but I predict it's going to be a lot bigger than it is now. I am less concerned with right now, this stage, I am less concerned with what other people think of the pulp revolution, or whether people think that, you know, whatever, if I'm being arrogant or not. I am more concerned with getting people excited about creating, recruiting new creators, excuse me, and investing in making sure that we've got a group of people who are as excited as possible about creating, who are convinced of the value of what they're doing, convinced that even if maybe they're not seeing some success right now, that they can see success and should keep working at it. I want people to, I'm basically out here, as a cheerleader.
Encouraging people to expand the market.
Yeah. Cheerleaders aren't there. They're there to make the players play harder. They're there to get the audience excited and up and cheering in the stands so the players play harder. It doesn't matter what the other side thinks. Cheerleaders aren't there to, you know, kick the other team off the field. They're not there to shoot opposing players. They're there to make players play harder, to inspire them, and then to inspire the audience to cheer loudly and jump up and down so that energy feeds back to the players. That's what I'm doing, basically.
I think we would all be well served if you decided to put on the trappings of the player and put something out there, kick a field goal or make a touchdown or something. I'm horrible with sports metaphors, but I think that you could write a really good SFF story. And if you ever decided to do that, I would be more than willing to buy it and promote it. So
I will say this. My theory that I have adopted over the past couple of years is that I don't like to talk about stuff until I have something worth shipping, until something's ready to go. At the very least, until I'm ready to put out a call for people to come in and take a look at it.
So there is something in the works.
I've been talking about this project I'm working on. I've been working on for a very, very long time. I have no idea how much longer I'm going to work at it. I have no ETA. I have no idea to tell people what it's going to happen, when it's going to happen, so I don't talk about it, at least recently. I haven't talked about it in 3 years or so in public. In private, I've talked to Kursova about one small part of it. About one small part of it. I've talked to Jeffro about another bit of it. I've been talking with John C. Wright about some other ideas that go into it. And I've talked with Brian Niemeyer when he came out here to Salt Lake City for Salt Lake City Comic Con about it. I am working on a big project. I've been working on this big project for, you wouldn't believe me if I told you how long I've been working on this project. It is absolutely massive. I am writing a role-playing game rules set.
Oh, shit.
And this rules set is one small part of this massive project. Was originally an action movie rule set, but I think it could fairly be described right now as a Pulp Revolution rule set. It's a set of rules that are designed to allow you to play through the stuff that would happen in a typical action movie. I've been doing a lot of research. I've been doing a lot of work on it. The first time I met Larry Correa is when I went out to a range to do some shooting of actual weapons. Got to shoot a Barrett 50 caliber. Got to shoot a 9mm pistol and stuff. Got to shoot an Uzi that was technically full automatic, but I didn't get to shoot it on full auto because it jammed when I pulled the trigger. Doing research for this role-playing game. So that's one part of the project. The other part of the project is absolutely massive, and it's been heavily impacted by the Pulp Revolution, by Appendix N stories. And so the setting that's going to be coming along with the rules is unimaginably huge, unimaginably varied, and is heavily, heavily, heavily impacted by the Pulp Revolution, by Appendix N, and I'm very excited about it. I'm not talking about it in public, because if I told you some details right now, and you think, oh, that's great, I want to, check that out, but then I'm not able to ship something for 2 years, or 2.5 years, or however long it takes me, then you're not going to be as excited. People aren't going to be as excited, so I'm not giving out specifics in public until I get closer to being able to do something concrete.
No, that's fine, man. I'm very excited about that. That sounds incredibly cool. Let me know when it ships, and I'll make a post on the blog and, a Twitter, probably mention it in a podcast and all of that stuff. I'd be more than willing to promote that. That sounds awesome.
I'm very, I can't tell people how excited I am. And here's the thing. Some people I know have been following me for a long time and have been following this project for a long time before I kind of went into, radio silence about it. If you're listening to this podcast, you're one of those people who've been following it for a long time, rest assured I'm doing work every single day to move towards getting something shipping. I'm not screwing around. It's just there is a ton of work to do. Like just this week and last week, I've been reading Creep Shadow by A. Merritt, and it's provided a lot of ideas, a lot of inspiration that has completely revolutionized some of the stuff I've been doing in one specific area of this. And now I'm having to, now that I've got all that inspiration and now I've taken all those notes, now I have to go through and write up a description, smooth it out, figure out how to apply it, work on the idea some more to make them shippable. You can't just take a really cool idea. Just one really cool idea that you write down that you're all excited about has to be surrounded by like 20 other ideas that don't sound as exciting, but are all necessary to make that great core idea work. You just have to put the work in. And I'm specifically talking about a role-playing game setting now, not necessarily a story. It may be applicable to stories, I don't know, but I can assure you, when you're building a role-playing game setting, when you're trying to build something coherent and comprehensive, that you need to have a bunch of other ideas that aren't individually all that exciting, but which make that one core idea work really, really well, that make it perfectly suited to be used in a game, and you have to think your way through it and smooth it out and, you know, apply it, work out all the kinks, and that's just not something that can be short circuited. That's not a process you can rush through. It's just something that has to...
You can't really cut corners with something like that.
Especially in such a massive project, because not only does that piece have to work in and of itself as an isolated piece, it also has to work in the context of the whole big thing.
Yeah. So. And, you know, it's one of the quotes I remember from Razor Fist is, you know, whenever you're playing a fantasy RPG, be it video game or tabletop or whatever, it comes as read that one of the classes will be snapped the fuck in half. Is, I believe, his exact words there. So if you want to kind of avoid that, then it really does take a lot of work. But I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to be here in 2 years, barring some major, incredible, mind-boggling, unimaginable fuck-up on your part. I'm still going to be following you on Twitter. I'm still going to be reading your website. I'm still going to be, reading your articles on Castalia House. And I'm still going to be looking forward to this project that you're putting out there. So, you know, whenever it comes out, and it has to come out when it comes out, I don't want to, encourage you to, rush things so that you can capitalize on hype faster or whatever. Whenever it comes out, I'll be more than willing to buy it and promote it. And if I'm able to get my terminally procrastinating ass to actually design a campaign, test it for you.
So I'd be excited about all that. All the people who want to come and test it, once it's ready to be, even provisionally released, I'll be happy to have people come and play, especially the rule set. I'm doing a lot of things different than you typically see in role-playing games. I think in a really, really good way. I think it'll make it's a very, very special and unique thing that people will get excited about playing. But here's the thing with role-playing rules. My thesis is that you want to make the rules that you have as robust and as simple as possible, but that are also delightful to play. You want to make them interesting so that people enjoy what they're doing. So they have goals and they're working together as a team, the role-playing party and stuff. And I've got a concept and a mechanic built into the core of the combat rules that is fairly unique. It's not totally unique. It's happened before. There's other people that have done similar things in a couple of rare cases before. But that it makes combat inherently a teamwork proposition. It's not just one person attacking one monster and then the next person attacking the next monster or whatever. And I'm excited about it. I think it'll be interesting to play. I think it'll be fun to play. I think it'll give a different dynamic to combat than you've tend to have seen before. And I want to get that right. I want to make sure it's right, because you want your mechanics to be something that are cool, that are interesting, that are involving, that are fun to play. The mechanics themselves are interesting, and they can serve as a good springboard for the imaginations of the players and the imagination of the game master. The only reason rules exist is to do everything it can to make gameplay enjoyable, and then let players and game masters make their own fun. I'm not the person who makes the game fun; they are. But I can at least ensure that, to the maximum extent possible, the rules don't get in the way of the enjoyment of players and game master.
Yeah, you can provide a template that their fun is able to be built off of. You know, you can provide the foundation that they can build their edifice on. So yeah, no, I totally respect what you're doing there, and I'm really excited to see what you come up with. You know, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. But I'm about three sheets to the wind, and I think that my dad is here at this point, so I need to go and you know, talk to him and hang out. I don't get to see him all that often. Jason, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. I'm glad that you reached out to me and asked to come on. Speaking of which, if anybody out there wants to come on the podcast, just get in touch and we'll set up a time. But I do appreciate you coming on. It's been a hell of a lot of fun talking this stuff over with you. And I hope that you'll be able to come back in the future. And thanks again for having me on the Geek Gab podcast. I really do appreciate it.
Oh yeah, we're happy to have you on. That was awesome. I'm glad I could come on and talk about some of these things. You know, especially I want people to be aware that an audience is not a bad thing. You want your audience; they're your meal ticket. You want to treat them well. You want to garner an audience as a writer. You want to just draw them in and get them excited about your stuff and excited about telling their friends about their stuff. Don't be afraid of being commercial. Don't be afraid of quote unquote selling out. Don't be afraid of making books. Don't be afraid of doing things that other people might call selling out. You want to make books that people want to pay for, and that's how you're going to make sure you can make a living at this. And that's what will, in the long run, you doing great stuff creatively is best for you as a writer. It's best for the pulp revolution.
And of course, you know, the main point of that is, I think at least, is that you're able to produce more content more often. You know, if you're doing this as your day job, then you're able to do it more often. So you'll be able to release more and more quality if you don't have to worry about going to your day job and, you know, doing the wage cuck, wage slave thing.
The more people we have created and the better they are at what they do, the better it is for everybody, because you can build an audience not just for yourself. You can draw people into reading so that they're used to reading short stories, they're used to reading pulp, you know, stuff with the pulp ethos in it, and that they'll be more willing to read other stuff by other pulp revolution authors. So any one of us who are doing well is making it better for all the rest of us who are creating. Trust me, that is the best. They call it a virtuous cycle in business. That is the best possible outcome, is that all of you begin creating awesome stuff, and then that will help not just you get an audience, but it'll help everybody else get an audience too. So when you see somebody in the pulp revolution who's succeeding, who's doing well, you should be happy, because they are drawing in people who can also read your stuff and can also pay for your stuff. They are pioneers who are helping you in the future be more successful.
And also one point that I would make in addition to that is that we're a small scene right now. So we have to pull ourselves up by each other's bootstraps. So if you see somebody out there like John Mollison releasing his new story, promote him. Put it, yeah, if you have a website, put it out on your website that, hey, this guy that I really like has released this thing. If you have a YouTube channel, make a YouTube video. If you have a Twitter, reblog the link to his Amazon store page with the novel. You know, just we all have to kind of come together and promote one another to draw our disparate audiences together, because people who are interested in me might not be interested in, you know, what John Mollison is saying over at Seagull Rising, or they might not be interested in what Raul Nianzi is saying at Seagull Rising. But if I promote their stuff, then I at least expose their stuff to my audience, and some of those people might buy it. We might get a little bit of cross-pollination between, I hesitate to call it fan bases because I don't really think I have a fan base, but, you know, we might get this cross-pollination effect where we're all building this market together, and it's going to take effort like that and supporting one another to make this scene become a subculture. So get behind your brothers in arms. We're all out here for the same reason. We're all out here for virtuous reasons. We're all out here for personal reasons. And I don't see why there should be any conflict between that, or why we should be jealous of one another, or try to disparage or what's the word I'm looking for? Drive sales away from that person in the interest of increasing your own sales. Like, if people buy, you know, stuff that John Mollison has written and stuff that Raul Nianzi has written and stuff that I've written when I finally fucking again, you know, get to publishing it, you know, I that's net gain. So we all need to be out here supporting one another. There's nothing but gain to be made.
All right. Thanks for having me on. You guys have a great night.
Just,
thanks for listening.
Right quick. Tell everybody where they can find you, just to be sure.
Easiest way to find me, I write on the Castalia House blog, Jason Jones. I do the Geek Gab podcast. Go to youtube.com/geekgab. youtube.com/geekgab. You can also subscribe to the iTunes Store, the Amazon Play Store, or just listen to us on SoundCloud. We're all available on Geek Gab there. And then I'm on Twitter under daddy_warpig. Don't forget the underscore. If you get a daddy warpig without the underscore there, you're not going to be getting an active account. So daddy_warpig on Twitter.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show, man. I really do appreciate it. It's been a hell of a fun talk. And thank you for coming on, man.